Partly sunny skies at 81 degrees. Welcome to this Friday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. What you hear is from the soundtrack of the groundbreaking 1977 television miniseries, Roots. It was based on the book by author Alex Haley. Roots chronicles the American origin of a family, starting with slavery. Well, let's be honest, for some, the topic of talking about the history of slavery in this country is uncomfortable, but it is necessary, and it is part of this nation's history, and part of Georgia's history, which leads us into this next segment. 2 years ago, construction workers discovered the remains of 105 people buried underneath the parking lot at the University of Georgia. They were found during an expansion project for the university's Baldwin Hall. 30 of the remains were preserved well enough to study, and researchers believe they are the remains of slaves. Earlier this year, UGA excavated the remains and held a reinterment service.
We are joined together in this sacred space by a deep sense of compassion and respect for these individuals, and by a strong sense of duty to commemorate the lives that they lived nearly two centuries ago. And this occasion provides all of us with an opportunity for meaningful reflection.
Well, this summer, researchers at UGA's Center for Geospatial Research began working on a project that would allow the public to visualize the conditions and environment during the time the slaves were living. Well, joining me now to talk more about this project is Dr. Marguerite Madden, professor and the director of UGA's Center for Geospatial Research. She joins me from the studios in Athens. Professor, thanks for taking the time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let's begin with this. What do you all know about the location of these graves? Was it once a cemetery, or is that really unclear?
My understanding, it was a burial ground. So it was part of 633 acres that were contributed to UGA by John Millage. So it dates to about 1801. There's a part of it remains with the monuments, and originally it seems to have extended from Jackson Street to Thomas Street and Baldwin to Broad. So it was a big patch of ground, and not all of it probably was used as burial ground, but people were buried there. Probably up until the Oconee Hill Cemetery was created in 1856, and then maybe a little beyond that.
You've had a chance to view these remains. What went through your mind the first time you saw them?
Oh, so actually I have not
viewed
the remains. No. So our project is more of a remote sensing project, and my idea was to look at old maps and old aerial photographs and try to recreate the environment that the people who were buried there may have lived and worked. So we found some old maps in the Hargrett Rare Books collection. And our first map that we have of Athens is 1874. There's actually a map before that, but it's not dated, that is hand-drawn and shows the burial ground. So we are taking these old maps and historical aerial photographs and bringing them all together into a common geographic coordinate system or framework and putting them into the computer.
Someone listening saying, okay, why? How do you take, how does that information then help connect you to the possible living conditions? I mean, one would argue, well, listen, if they were slaves, that, in a sense, gives you a little bit of an idea of what their living conditions might have been like.
Right. So I'm interested in the land use patterns and the three-dimensional landscape as well. I hired two recent graduates from Cedar Shoals High School, so two local individuals are learning the system, and we've gotten a lot of history books of Athens history. We're looking at census data. We're going over to the Hargrett Library and reading documents that are from the old Athens Cemetery Foundation, some correspondence letters, which would have been written by descendants mm-hmm. of the people who are buried there, and just trying to piece together factories that slaves were working at and people were hired to work there, the planters who would have owned slaves at the time, the big houses, the prominent families that might have owned slaves. So just taking bits and pieces of history and try to put them on the maps.
In fact, the remains that were discovered, they've actually become a research project for several departments at the university.
That's right. For this part of the project, we're just working in geography. Mm-hmm. But our intent is to, when we have this geographic visualization database all together, is to really bring in people from the history department, archaeology, anthropology, African American studies, and the Athens community together to look at this time series of old maps and images. We've also got old photographs from books and narratives, graphs of census data. Bring this all together and have everybody look at it, and perhaps this would start some discussion within the community.
And for your department, what have you all discovered thus far? Anything you can give us some insight into?
Well, we may have identified or have the names of two individuals that were possibly buried in the old Athens Cemetery. And it was a descendant looking for the grave of her grandparents. And she noted that they, in parentheses, that they were mulattoes. And that's the only reference that we found of anyone of color that were buried there. So perhaps we have the names of two individuals.
Tell me more about this time series visualization and how you all are able to create that.
So it's a geographic information system, which is basically taking, it could be satellite data, aerial photographs, maps, any kind of geographic data, and bringing them all together into one geographic framework. And we our intent is to put this online in something called a story map. Mm-hmm. So it would be available. We could bring it on a tablet, or we could have somebody just look it up online, and it would step anybody through the timeline of starting with the oldest map and going on into, we have our oldest photographs are 1938, and that was the year that Baldwin Hall was constructed. So we can look at the area that was the old Athens Cemetery, and also the Oconee Hill Cemetery and all the area around it. We have very detailed photos from 1947 and then 1973, and many dates leading up to the present. So you can really see changes in Athens. One particular map dated in 1925, and it shows outlines of residential areas, and then other areas called the colored sections, and then industrial and commercial areas. So we have the designated areas in Athens that were virtually segregated.
There's a DNA project that another department will be working on, but how crucial is it as the other departments, as their information is being developed and compiled, that also helps you all in what you're doing? Because I imagine the DNA part of this is going to be so key.
It is very interesting, and there's a possibility that there are people here in Athens that were related or are related to individuals who were buried there. And other folks just might be very interested in learning about the history of these cemeteries. So the DNA information is giving some ideas about the health, the work, just trying to reconstruct the lives of these people, I think is a fascinating part of this study.
As you're digging through these historical maps, and I'm curious in the condition that they've been kept in,
So we're very fortunate. We go to the Hargett Library and they scan the maps. So we don't actually touch them. But I have brought the graduate students and the high school students over to see their equipment and how they handle these old documents and going through the original letters. We are able to handle those materials. So it's touching history, which is I think an interesting opportunity for them.
You worked on a lot of research projects. What has it been like to work on this one, and how unique is it?
Most of my previous work has been more ecological or environmental. Mm-hmm. My background is biology, ecology, with geographic techniques. So I'm used to looking at natural vegetation and land use changes and the landscape in three dimensions and how it changes over time. So this is really adding much more of a human component. I've worked somewhat with the influence of animals on landscapes and how animals move through the landscape, but not really reaching back into the historical documents and the history, especially of Athens, where I've lived for 33 years. And it's time to really understand the history of where I live.
Professor Madden, I want you to come outside of your research and professor, take that hat off for a moment. In general, what role do you think a project like this can play in perhaps opening up discussions about not just the history as it relates to slavery, but in general? Because as I mentioned coming into this segment, a lot of people are so uncomfortable even talking about the topic of slavery. But, you know, your personal reflection on that.
Well, I think it's a platform is what I'd like to think of it as, an avenue for having people all come together and really, really look at their own hometown and their history of, the slavery and segregation and integration and, it happened here where we live, and for all of us to look at how the landscape has changed over time and add our own stories to this.
You mentioned the high school students that are working with you. This is all part of something personal for you as part of this research. You wanted to get minority high school students that are interested in STEM, you wanted to get them involved in this project.
I did. And, I'm a teacher, and I know the value of learning geographic techniques. Always helped me to get a job. My father was a surveyor, and I started surveying when I was 11, and he was making maps. And I think just introducing two bright young individuals to this world of skills and a very interdisciplinary project, I thought it would be a great opportunity for a couple of high school students.
And what have they told you? What's the feedback been like?
It's interesting. They're both college bound. So Nicholas Moon has started at the University of North Georgia, but he's continuing to work with us part-time through this semester. And Aza Nguyen, she will be coming here to UGA in the spring. So she had a semester in between. And, I think they like it. They're very good. Young people have been playing video games and working with computers all their lives, so it really, they're natural computer users and mappers. So they're doing a great job at georectifying these old photographs and going through the old documents and the history books that we've collected.
You've collected this data. You plan to place it online for people to experience. When will all this be complete?
I'm hoping by December. So we have most of the dates completed, and now we're bringing them together into the story map format. So I think a couple more months we should have something to show. It'll be a living document. So as we find more information, more photos, more maps, we can continually add to it as well.
All right. Dr. Marguerite Madden, she's a professor and director of UGA's Center for Geospatial Research. And we've been talking about her research involving the remains of slaves discovered on the university's campus. Professor, thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Support for WABE comes from Comcast Business. Comcast is committed to providing dependable internet service for businesses who depend on it. Comcast Business, internet, voice, and TV, built for business. And from Reliable Heating and Air, a Train dealer, a family company since 1978, offering heating and air, plumbing, electrical, and duct cleaning 24 hours a day. Learn more at reliableair.com.
When you're catching up on the day's news, the headlines are a good place to start. But to really understand the world and what's happening, you want the full story. All Things Considered takes the time to explore the details and differences to find meaning in the day's biggest stories. Stand with the facts. Listen every day. Join us weekday afternoons from 4 until 6:30 for All Things Considered here on 90.1 WABE.
You're listening to Closer Look. If you missed any of today's conversation, catch up on our website at wabe.org/closerlook. Again, wabe.org/closerlook. Also, we want to hear from you. Send our host, Rose Scott, an email at rose@wabe.org. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.
My name is Debbie, and I live in Lake Claire, which is right by Candler Park. If I had to add some things or change some things around, I probably would add more places like Lady Bird on the Beltline, so more casual restaurants without having to walk through necessarily a mall to get to them.
I'm Howard, and I live in North Druid Hills area. I'd like to see a way of dealing with the traffic in my neighborhood. It's just crazy. In fact, we figured back ways to go out. We don't go on North Druid Hills. It's just a standstill, you know.
My name is Lucky, and I live in Midtown. I would like to see for my neighborhood to chill out on the building of really expensive apartments, because I'm getting moved out of my cool little artistic community. We're the last of those folks that are finally getting bought out.
On the next Fresh Air, Bruce Springsteen. His critically acclaimed and best-selling memoir, Born to Run, is now out in paperback. We'll listen back to the interview I recorded at his home studio in New Jersey, where we talked about growing up and the experiences that shaped his life and music. Join us this afternoon at 2 on 90.1 WABE. And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. As always, I'm Rose Scott. Tens of thousands of people from the Rohingya community in Myanmar, in case you know, they are fleeing. They're fleeing to Bangladesh, a neighboring country in the same region. They are escaping violent attacks from government forces in Myanmar, previously known as Burma. Closer Look producer Finley Foxen spoke with Mohammed Iyub, who is of the Rohingya community, but he's been living here in Clarkston, Georgia now for 5 years.
I was born in Burma, so I came to Bangladesh to go to Malaysia. My journey was to go to Malaysia. So unfortunately, I cannot reach the Malaysia because I was going by boat. So on the way, our boat is broken. That's why, you know, I cannot reach. Then Sri Lanka Navy, they took us in the Sri Lanka. So I have been there as a refugee 4 years, Sri Lanka. Then the UNHCR, they have a resettlement process, and they brought in United States.
Now, Muhammad told Finley his account of what is taking place in Myanmar.
August 25th, military, they came to the village by village. They burning down the village, and they raping the women, and they killing the Rohingya people. They throwing the children on the fire, Rohingya children. And when the people come from the village, the military, they shoot and they kill them. And I told my parents, look at the property, houses, don't look anything, just save your life. And we have nearby, they have one small river. I told them just pass the river and stay over there. After like 4 or 5 days, I could not contact them. I thought, you know, they have been killed. So fortunately, after 4 or 5 days, they called me. They said they are alive. They came to Bangladesh. I don't know what they will do, but only God can help them. Burma government think Rohingya people came from Bangladesh. That's why they are persecuted. They try to finish the, it's called the ethnic cleansing or genocide. They try to finish the whole Rohingya people. When I was about 16, I was going to a school. On the way, there is one military station over there. They called me and they told me to do their work. And I told them I was late for school. And because of that, why I told them, that's why they beaten me over there. Then my dad, he has more than 20 acre land. And it's like a paddy field land. So the one day the military, they came, they confiscated all the land from my dad and also other villager land. And then they brought some Rakan people from a different state, from different city. They give it to all the land to them.
Now we're going to learn more about the Rohingya community in Myanmar. Join me in studio is Tinaz Parvi. She's professor of political science and division chair of social sciences and humanities and founding director of Asian Studies program at Spelman College. Professor, thanks for coming in and taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with some history here. The Rohingya community, they've lived in the Myanmar region for centuries. But take us through the history of the Rohingya community and their migration to Myanmar to begin with.
Yes. So, you know, as with many such cases, the history is contested. So if you talk to the majority of the Buddhist Burmese who live there, you know, they contest this kind of idea that the Rohingya have always been there. But of course, the Rohingya, and it has been well documented by many other sources, have been there for centuries. Some of them trace their history back to the region to about the 1200s, when there were kind of Arab traders and so forth into the South Asia region. And then, of course, you know, you had British colonialism of what was formerly British India that included what is now Pakistan and what is now Bangladesh. And of course, the British ruled over Burma as well. And so there were also population movements during that time. So that brings us up into, you know, the 1900s, so to speak. And so they've claimed that they've always had a presence in the Rakhine region, which borders both Myanmar as well as Bangladesh, the newly created state of Bangladesh in 1971 from what was originally Pakistan. And, you know, that they have a right to live there, that their ancestors have always lived there. But it has been contested, and increasingly so recently, by the Burmese, the Burmese Buddhists. It's been complicated by a number of things. I think one of the key things that is bringing much of these tensions to the fore in very recent times is Burma's opening to the world, so to speak. You know, the military dictatorship has ceded kind of some of its power to civilian rule, although they still hold most of the power in Myanmar. And of course, there's been a lot of kind of economic development in the region. And I think that this has just changed so many dynamics within Myanmar, and it's bringing to the fore old, you know, hatreds, old animosities, and new tensions.
Because often lately we've been hearing that the core of this violence against the Rohingya, which are mostly majority Muslim, living in the majority Buddhist Myanmar. So you some call it ethnic cleansing, some say it's more of a religion. How do you see this? And you said it's complicated. So
right.
Depending on whom you ask, you'll get a different answer.
That's true. And if you, I think Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel Prize laureate, and some have been demanding greater kind of accountability from her, like where is her voice in this terrible tragedy that's happening in her own country. So recently, I believe she was quoted as saying that it is not a genocide and that it is the iceberg of misinformation, you know, that the Western world is putting out. But there's no denying that religion is one of the key sources of this tension. Many Buddhists in Myanmar today, I think because of the very recent globalization that has turned their world upside down in a way, feel that their religion and their ethnicity is under siege. I'm not quite sure why, but these are things that we never know with people all over the world, right? Like, why, when you're a majority, why are you feeling besieged? But that is the answer they give. But certainly there's religious prejudice, there is ethnic prejudice, there's linguistic prejudice, because the Rohingya speak a different dialect, and some of the Burmese will simply call them Bengali, you know, that they are simply Bangladeshis who have been coming in the last few decades, not the last few centuries.
I hope this doesn't sound like a silly question, but how many ethnic groups are there technically, I guess, in Myanmar?
There are quite a few.
Right.
So
why just the tension between these two groups? Is it solely because it's Muslim and Buddhist?
I think the religion, I mean, one has to conclude that the religion has quite a lot to do with it. So there are much smaller groups. There are Christians. There are Hindus who have always lived in Myanmar as well, part of the whole British colonial kind of effect in the region with demographic shifts. And then within the Burmese Buddhists as well, there are ethnic differences. And in fact, and this is something that we don't often hear about, the government, the Myanmar government, has been involved in actually violent skirmishes with these other ethnic groups who are ethnically, I suppose, part of the larger Myanmarese identity. So there's all this other stuff going on as well, but the Rohingya are the Islamic group.
The Rohingya community is classified as stateless. Are they the only community that's classified as stateless there? And what does that mean for our
listeners? In a sense, right? So they are de facto stateless. They may not, in a sense, just because the government over the last many decades has been involved in taking away their rights. And so they have effectively left them stateless, even if, you know, in reality, they're not stateless, because the Rakhine is their area, their land that they've always lived on, that they've claimed for quite a long time. But over the past few decades, and maybe even a century or more, the government has been kind of bearing down those rights. So their right to acquire land, for instance, their right to jobs, for instance, in the region is quite severely restricted when you compare it to other Burmese. And then one of the things that really has caused a consternation in the last couple of years is a law that came down from the government that further restricted and had some religious implications. Things like, you may not proselytize. And many people thought that it was directed against the Muslim minority more than any other religious group.
You mentioned the state chancellor. How much control does a state chancellor have over the military?
Not a whole lot, right? So Suu Kyi has this new position. She's definitely got a lot of political power, and much of her power comes from the fact that her political party, the NLD, was recently elected with about 80% of the popular vote. So she definitely has that power. But when you compare it to, the power that the military holds, she could easily lose her position if she strongly contradicts the military and they are not happy with it. So she is also walking a very delicate balance between how much she can speak out against what is happening and losing, in effect, her entire position, which the military very well could do.
The Rohingya community is fleeing to Bangladesh. How receptive is that nation to this community?
Right, that's a good question. And so one would think, if, you know, they have some ties with Bangladesh, they are both Muslim entities, but Bangladesh has not been very welcoming. In fact, you know, they don't allow them in. They are constricted to a very small kind of border, no man's land, where the refugee camps are in terrible shape, mm-hmm. they're certainly not welcomed.
There's nowhere else to turn, in a
That's
sense.
Right. That's right. And some of them are in India as well, Rose. They have gone as refugees into the Indian part of, Bengal, and they're certainly not welcome there as well. And in fact, one of the interesting things that is happening now as this conflict becomes internationalized is you have the world community, including the Western world, you know, saying, what are we doing about the plight of the Rohingya? Mm-hmm. But you've got India and China saying that we support the Burmese government.
And therein lies another problem when you talk about those two nations and the power they have. The international community is calling this an ethnic cleansing. How do you see it?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that you can't escape the fact that, when you think about those graphic images of hundreds of thousands of people fleeing an area, they're fleeing out of desperation. Nobody would do that if the conditions didn't force them to take such desperate measures, right? So in that sense, I would agree that it is.
Can you even begin to figure out how all this will end?
Right. It's a very difficult situation. So I think one of the keys is really what is the global response going to be? And I think recently you've had a very much ramped up kind of, everybody has heard about mm-hmm. the Rohingya in the news. But, a couple of years ago, nobody did. But this has been an ongoing problem. Well, the fact that at least we are, it's never too late. But I think that it is, if you have two huge major powers like India and China, regional mm-hmm. powers, India, right on the border, that essentially support the military against their actions, or rather in favor of their actions against the Rohingya, it becomes very difficult. But then on the other hand, if you look at the larger Asia region, mm-hmm. Majority Muslim countries like Indonesia have really started speaking out against the Burmese government. So it's very complicated. And I believe that there are now substantial and credible reports that there is a radicalizing element mm-hmm. Certainly on both sides. So on the side of the Rohingya, ISIS has started to infiltrate that region. And on the side of the Burmese, there are actually so-called radicalized Burmese monks. They have a religious yeah. mm-hmm. kind of affiliation, but they are also out there giving these fiery speeches about their community and how it has to be saved, and about racial purity, about religious purity, all of these kinds of things.
This could go on for years, decades, more centuries.
Yes, it does. It's definitely not something that has an easy solution. But perhaps, if everybody could just be more thoughtful, to have empathy for the other side. And it's difficult to understand.
And when you say that, and yes. we've talked about conflicts around
right.
the, world
the world
before.
Right?
And when you say that, it sounds simplistic, yeah. but, with all the different factors from government to religion, it's never easy.
It is never easy, Rose. Absolutely.
What do you tell your students about this?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I always talk to the students about, and, I teach South Asia, among other things, in international relations, I think that even just presenting the history, as you started with today, makes them think in a different way. So they come into it only having the knowledge that they have from, watching what is on the news, right? Mm-hmm. But presenting kind of a deeper historical context, trying to show how many different facets there are to the conflict, then trying to make them understand who are the big regional powers and how can they influence the conflict. So it's not just then between two groups, but it becomes between many, many different kinds of interested actors.
And that's what history is all about. Professor Tinaz Parviu, Professor of Political Science and Division Chair of Social Sciences and Humanities and Founding Director of the Asian Studies Program at Spelman College. My producer, Candace Wheeler, it's a mandate that I have to say that she is a Spelman alumna and she appreciates this as well.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Rose.
Thank you for coming in. Thank you for the education.
Thank you.
Support for WABE comes from Himalayan Children's Charities, serving orphans from impoverished and disaster-affected communities in Nepal since 2000, creating dignified futures through community leadership. For more information, you can visit hccnepal.org. And from Live Nation, presenting Dead & Company at Phillips Arena on November 29th. Tickets go on sale this Saturday at 10 a.m. at livenation.com. That's Dead & Company returning to Atlanta November 29th.
Community issues are what drives the conversations here on Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Tell me what's happening where you live. Send an email to rose@wabe.org. Again, that's rose@wabe.org. This is member support at 90.1 WABE Atlanta.
My name is Will, and I live in Decatur. I would say it's like a university town, but with adults, more adults. I like that it's close to Atlanta, but it's also its own kind of town. Well, I like downtown Decatur. It's easier to walk around. It's less spread out. Not really wild about the strip mall parts of like Lawrenceville Highway and North Druid Hills. Like the traffic's really bad and I don't know how many more McDonald's we need.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Hurricane Irma swept through the Caribbean and destroyed not only homes, but resorts and hotels, hitting the island's vital tourism industry hard. We'll check in on recovery efforts there and what it'll take to restart tourism on islands that have been devastated. And we'll hear about the end of NASA's Cassini mission exploring Saturn and its moons. That's next time on Here and Now. Weekdays at noon on 90.1 WABE.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. Now, don't blame me for this next line. All homes built before 1978 likely contain some lead-based paint. That's according to the CDC. The older the home, the greater the chance for deterioration of paint and the greater the chance for what's called lead-contaminated house dust. And with that comes a greater risk for lead exposure. Now, the CDC found that nearly 24 million housing units in this country fall into this category. Now, here in Georgia, one woman describes just a few of the places that lead was found in her home.
Front door, window sills, back doors, bedrooms, bathroom. Practically the whole house.
That's from an investigative series by WebMD and Georgia Health News. It's the second installment in the series, which looks at the impact of lead exposure. And they're returning to Closer Look with more about the report. The lead authors, Brenda Goodman, is a senior news writer for WebMD, and our good buddy Andy Millers, editor and CEO of Georgia Health News. Brenda, you're our good buddy, too. Welcome back. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having us, Rose.
Thanks, Rose.
Let's set the stage for someone who might be listening for the first time and go back for a moment and talk about how and why you all originally decided to begin this series.
Well, I think it came about after what happened in Flint, Michigan, where we had such a high percentage of kids that developed lead poisoning because of the errors in that the administrators did with the water supply there. And I think everybody in our business, the healthcare journalism business, kind of got focused on, okay, what's happening in our community? Do we have lead problems here, either in water or paint or anything like that? So Brenda and I have been looking at this problem over the course of now, I guess it's been a year. And there's very many facets to the problem. And I think every community probably has a lead problem to some degree.
And Brenda, folks may not want to hear that, but let's go back and talk about the origin of what you all found in terms of where the lead contamination is coming from. Are we talking about mostly paint, water, combination?
Well, lead was so pervasive in everyday life up to a certain point. Like lead paint was phased out in 1978. So homes built before 1978 are likely to have lead paint. And it's still a danger. I mean, that lead is one of those problems. Lead is, has been forgotten, but it's not gone. And it's been forgotten in our minds and forgotten in the minds of doctors. They forget to test for it. They don't monitor for it. So it's something we felt deserved more attention than it's getting, for sure, because the problem definitely has not been solved.
In the first part of your series, you all mentioned that during the course of your research, you found that the utilities were responsible for tracking what was called lead service lines. And I want to get into that for a moment, and let's back up and go back again and talk about these lead service lines. What are they? Where do they come from?
Right. So even older than paint is lead in our water supply. Lead has been used in piping. In fact, the word for plumbing comes from plumbum, the Latin for lead. It's been used in pipes in major cities around the world. I think Paris, Rome had lead pipes. And they knew as far back as the turn of the century that it could be dangerous for health and that it could get into water. But we didn't solve that problem for a long, long time.
Andy?
And basically is what happened in Flint, where they had these lead service lines and they switched water supplies and they didn't treat the water to the extent that they did. And so lead leached from these service lines or pipes into the regular drinking water there. And kids and adults consumed it to the point where a lot of kids got poisoned. Remember that there's no safe level of lead for a child, according to the CDC. And what happened there was obviously a tragedy, and unfortunately, there's still a lot of these lead pipes in Georgia and every other state. They're out there, and basically, they need to be replaced because these things are very dangerous in terms of consuming water that has this poison in it.
And utilities have lost track, of where those pipes are. Yeah.
Well, that was my next question. They've lost track of where these pipes. How do you lose track?
Well, the way it was explained to us by a longtime water expert is that when they would go out to install a pipe in your house, the guy who's doing that often was a tradesman. He was sometimes literate, sometimes not. Some cities have very careful handwritten records about where those pipes are, but they were all on paper. And so over the years, those paper records have been lost, destroyed. I mean, you can imagine you trying to keep up with your own records at home. It's pretty tough. But for a utility with hundreds and hundreds of homes, they're often just gone with time.
And is this more challenging in the rural community as opposed to the urban metropolis like Atlanta, or is it everybody's at risk here?
Well, I think it depends on where you are in the utility, how it's testing homes for it, in terms of their water for lead. Some utilities are doing a good job in terms of it being very scrupulous and testing high-risk homes, and there are other communities that are just not doing the right thing. They're not testing high-risk homes, or they're even testing businesses and commercial establishments when they really should be testing these homes that have high risk for lead contamination. Either they have these lead service lines, or they were built between the 83 and 88 when they had a high level of lead solder, or the homes that have lead plumbing. And those are the homes that should be targeted by water utilities for testing. But oftentimes, many of these utilities aren't looking for them.
There's always a human aspect. And you all looked at the effect of lead poisoning on families. And you shared the story of a Georgia resident, Austin is a petite. And at just 16 months old, and Brenda, I'll let you pick up the story from there.
So his family, they were a new family. They had just had a baby, and they moved into an old house in Ashburn, Georgia, and it was over 100 years old. And they noticed the peeling paint everywhere, but didn't really think anything of it. They were so thrilled to be in a house. They're a lower income family, and they were happy to be in a house of that size and to have two bedrooms. And you know, they didn't really think anything about the health risks of the peeling paint. And so when he went for his regular checkup, the family was on Medicaid. Lots of kids in Georgia are enrolled in the Medicaid and covered by Medicaid. They did the blood test that they're required to do by law. Kids in Medicaid are supposed to get a blood test at a year and at 2 years of age. So he got his blood test done, and it showed high levels of lead, and it just upended their lives.
And this was, he was 16 months old at the time of his first test.
Yep, she was a little late getting that mm-hmm. first checkup.
Andy, any idea how that was consumed? Was it just through the paint on the walls? Was it through water? What was this through?
Well, kids that young tend to put stuff in their mouth all mm-hmm. the time and chew things. So Austin's mom thinks it was kind of the peeling paint. Maybe it was on the window ledge, or maybe it was household dust. But that's one common way where kids can get lead poisoning, just by putting things in their mouth like chips, little paint chips that may taste sweet to them, mm-hmm. or just, you know, playing around in the dust that may have the lead contamination in it in the home.
That's one of the horrifying things about lead to me, is that it tastes sweet. I didn't know that until we started reporting this story. So kids, when they taste it, want to suck on it, and it's such a potent toxin to their brains. It's awful.
Brenda, I understand that according to the CDC, his poisoning level was more than three times as high as, I guess, what they would say would be typical or normal. Three times.
Right. So no level of lead is safe, and they've documented health effects even at very low levels, like 1 and 2 milligrams per deciliter is the unit they use to measure it in blood. When you hit a level of 5, they start to count you as high, and between 5 and 9, they sort of monitor you. And then once you hit a level of 10 or higher, the Department of Health, the Georgia Department of Public Health, is supposed to come in and do a lead investigation to find out where that lead is coming from and stop it.
Andy, we're going to get into a segment now, which I might get some emails on, but let's be clear here. That now we know that he's nearly 3 years old. He was officially diagnosed with on the autism spectrum, correct?
Right.
Do we have any concrete data that correlates the connection between lead poison and autism?
Well, there's some kind of link there, Rose, because autistic kids, and we think the autism happened before the lead poisoning, and they might use their hands a lot more. They may go to their mouth a lot mm-hmm. more, these kids with autism. And I think there's a relationship there in terms of he may be more prone to put things in his mouth because he's autistic.
And there was another child also, correct? Is this Monty? Is this a different?
He has a younger brother, correct.
And Monty also tested positive? Or
she was pregnant when they found out that.
Oh, and I'm sorry.
Right. No, yeah. That's okay. She was pregnant when they found out that Austin tested high. And that was terrifying because, as you can imagine, you're carrying a child at its most vulnerable stages in your womb. And you find out that your child is being exposed to lead somehow. And she didn't know why. But she was tested when she was pregnant, and she did not have high lead. So she started asking herself, what is Austin doing that I'm not doing? And he was spending a lot of time standing up at the windows of their home, looking out the windows.
And that family has since moved, I take it?
They have, yeah.
And that was precisely the right thing for her to do, is she realized that, you know, her son was being poisoned, and they got out of there pretty fast.
How many families did you all talk to? Did you discover any other families that had experienced the same thing?
Well, we've talked to a lot of families over the course of our reporting, whether it's from the problem, this was a problem with the paint, but we also talked to a lot of families that had water issues, lead in their water, high levels of lead.
Brenda, are you all able to, in your research, find any answers? Does any entity, any government entity, anybody have any solutions to how to combat this? I mean, there are a lot of homes that were built before 1978. I grew up in an old Irish row house in St. Louis that was built in 1912. So did you find anywhere that there was a solution to all this? I mean, can you replace all the pipes in this country? Probably not, but.
So there was a great report that just came out from the Pew Charitable Trust and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation that looked at solutions. What can we do about this lead problem that we still have? And one of the key things in some states is that they have instituted, you have to go out and get a certificate before you can rent your property, and they have to come in and do a health and safety inspection to get that certificate. So I think this is in Rochester, New York. So before you can even rent a property, it has to be inspected. It has to be certified safe for someone to live there. And we don't have anything like that in Georgia.
But Andy, you all also cited in your report that Georgia Supreme Court issued a decision last year that makes it difficult for families to even sue over lead poisoning.
That's correct. If you get contaminated from lead and you're a renter, basically, and the policy, the insurance policy, the landlord has an exclusion for pollution. The court ruled that lead is part of that pollution exclusion, and you can't sue for damages under that. Now, that's unlike other states where it's much where the courts have said they don't consider lead contamination to be part of that exclusion clause in the insurance policies.
Now, I know you all are not doctors, but I know there are a lot of listeners listening to this segment who might be concerned. Are there any common signs in terms of symptoms that might indicate there's some lead poisoning?
So at low levels, there usually are no symptoms, but it's still damaging a child's brain, and it's harming their attention, and it's harming their intelligence. And those problems start to show up when a child reaches school age. They might be attention deficit disorder, hyperactivity, things like that start to show up. It's subtle. The lead levels have to be pretty, pretty high before you get symptoms like anemia, stomach pains. A child can be hospitalized. They can die from lead, from really, really high levels. But usually it's lower levels that kind of fly under the radar.
Andy, you all have been working on this for, if not a year, just a little bit over a year. What's been the takeaway for you out of all of this?
I think just general consumers should be made aware or become educated on this issue. If you have a young child or you're of childbearing age and you want to raise a family, you really should check out the home that you're renting or about to buy or you're living in. I mean, that's ultimately very important for you. But I think it's something that we could do a lot better on, both as a society and also as government, to go into these homes and try to repair some of them or to alert people of the problems.
Brenda, I'll give you the last word, because I want to ask about any feedback or response from the utilities that are responsible for tracking those lead service lines. Anybody get back to you?
You know, it's been remarkably quiet, but a lot of media picked up the story, including you guys. So mm-hmm. That's been wonderful. And I think WSB is planning an investigative report for this November. They're going to do their own project. So I'm glad that it's getting more attention, because it definitely needs it.
Brenda Goodman, senior news writer for WebMD, and Andy Miller, editor and CEO of Georgia Health News. We've been talking about their report, which looks at the impact of lead exposure right here in this state. Thank you all so much for coming back and giving us an update. I really appreciate it. Good work.
Thanks for having us.
I love talking to journalists. And that's it for today's edition of Closer Look, which is produced by Spelman alumni Candace Wheeler, Ebony Lemon, and Finley Fox. And our engineer is Elizabeth Eads. Our executive producer is Christine Dempsey. A special thanks to the entire WAB News team. Also, our digital services crew, because they keep us on the web. You can visit wabe.org/closerlook, and you can now listen to this program weeknights at 9 p.m. We're back this Sunday at 1. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott.